morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome now Sandy Buffett. She is the Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here again.
Good to have you back in this 60-day legislative session. Ooh. This is the big time of the year, or the time of the 2 years, really, for your organization.
It sure is. We're right in the midst of the long 60-day legislative session. And let me just tell you a little bit about what Conservation Voters New Mexico is. We're a nonprofit organization that works to turn our shared environmental values into robust state priorities. And we do that by engaging in the political process on behalf of the environmental community so that we can pass strong policies that protect our air, land, water, wildlife, and the quality of life that we really love and the reasons why we love New Mexico.
Big job.
Yes. You know, we're one of the only full-time environmental lobbyists in the building. We have hundreds of bills to track when the other side, the polluting special interests, often have a dozen per company or more lobbyists working for them. So it is sort of a David and Goliath situation.
And it really highlights the extent to which pollution, environmental protection, and all those things are based on relationships.
Oh, they sure are based on relationships. And that's why it's important for us to engage in the political process and make sure that we have a voice in the policymaking process. You know, this year we expect several thousand bills to be introduced, possibly up to 4,000, 4,500 bills. And every year about 20% of the bills we see introduced at the Santa Fe Roundhouse have an environmental impact. So we're tracking several hundred bills at a time. And
That's a lot of bills.
It's a lot of bills for, you know, one lobbyist and one intern to be tracking. But we do stay on top of it, and we inform our environmental champions in the House and Senate which bills that we're opposing or supporting. And then, of course, as I've mentioned on other shows here, we do an annual environmental scorecard so that citizens can know exactly how they're being represented, if their environmental values are being represented by their state representatives and senators.
And that helps them make choices on election day.
Well, that's right. We do score the legislators 0 to 100%, and that informs our endorsement process. We are a 501c4 organization that has a political action committee, which means we can endorse candidates and then work to elect pro-environment candidates and work to defeat, frankly, anti-environment candidates.
So this year, it seems like Conservation Voters New Mexico did have an impact in the sense that there are more pro-environmental legislators than there were last time around. Is that correct?
That's right. When we started this about 4 years ago, we set a plan up through the 2013 legislative session, and I'm very pleased to report that we're ahead of schedule on our plan. In the 2008 election, 17 out of our 20 endorsed candidates won. We also converted 8 seats from seats that we had analyzed as being anti-environment seats and out of step with their voters. We converted those into pro-environment seats. So
I think the out of step with the voters needs to be emphasized. When you have people who really are not representing their legislative district, that's a problem.
Exactly. And, you know, the way the legislature has worked in past years, the webcam, which is the new development of this year, and the audio streaming is really going to help voters know what's going on. It's starting to happen. I mean, they appropriated money a few sessions back for it, and they've stalled on it.
People didn't want to have to, like, do their hair and things like that.
Well, anything that can provide more sunshine and transparency to what's going on up there, especially for communities, you know, you don't want to have to drive 5 hours to hear a committee and then find out that it's been, you know, that your bill is not going to be heard after all. So that is really discouraging the way it's been set up over the decades. It's not very inclusive for the everyday citizen to grasp you know, the issues that they care about and where they're at in the pipeline of committee hearings and such. So
now we're not quite halfway at the halfway point of the legislative session, but can people in Deming turn on their internet connection and see the legislature in action?
Well, right now I believe the audio is up and running and we're moving towards webcasting, but most other states have this already. So
that's interesting. So that's yeah, right. Now we've talked about that with Linda Siegel. That is the important part, is hearing it.
Right. But let me just mention, you know, a few of our pro-environment champions, especially in the Senate. We helped elect Senator Eric Griego, Senator Tim Keller, Senator John Sapien, Senator Tim Eichenberg. All of those are from the Bernalillo County area, and also Senator Steve Fishman from Las Cruces, and of course Peter Wirth. We went from a representative of Santa Fe to now state senator, and he's been a consistent environmental champion for us. And then also several members in the House. You know, Representative Brian E. Golf took Peter Wirth's House seat. We helped elect Representatives Bill O'Neill, Ben Rotifer, and Eleanor Chavez in Albuquerque. And we do that, you know, we go door to door and talk to voters about the issues at stake in this, sometimes in the midst of a federal presidential year. So
right.
It's hard to find out, you know, where candidates at the state level stand on the issues that voters care about. So we go out and go door to door. We do all the electoral programs that to help get out the vote for our pro-environment candidates.
Did the fact that voter turnout was relatively high this year in the presidential election help New Mexico pro-environmental candidates? Did the whole Barack Obama phenomenon have an effect, do you think, on your
work?
Certainly.
I mean, in turnout, definitely. I will say we are a nonpartisan organization, and we endorse across the parties. We had a Green endorsement, Republican endorsements, and Democratic endorsements. So we just find that more and more the environment, renewable energy, green jobs are issues that voters are starting to make front burner issues when they go vote.
Well, that's an extremely interesting development, that it has become really a mainstream issue of deep concern because people know that it affects their health.
Right, of course. And then, you know, by having a electoral voice from the environmental community helping good pro-environment folks get elected, it's an alternative to what's existed in the past and still exists, and that's the polluting special interests getting their folks elected. So now we finally have a counterbalance to work towards getting a pro-environment majority at the state legislature and city councils and the public, the PRC, and at all levels of state government. So I hope to be able to report by 2013 that we have that pro-environment majority.
I love hearing 2013 because it's after the end of the Mayan calendar.
Oh, I didn't know that.
As an aside, as a talk show host, I get so much email publicizing things, and one of the things is how the world is going to end in 2012. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not endorse that viewpoint. So Conservation Voters New Mexico is very busy looking at the bills that are before the legislature now. As you've said, hundreds of them, 20% of the total number of bills, have an effect on the environment one way or the other. Some bills you're supporting, some bills you're opposing.
Correct.
Let's talk about both of those.
Sure. Well, we are a nonprofit organization, so that means, by definition, we're resource-strapped. With so many bills, a deluge of bills, our first priority is to fight the bad stuff first. And over the last 3 years, we have had 100% rate of defense stopping all the bad bills.
That's extraordinary.
And last year, we had to request one veto from the governor on a bad uranium bill, which helped us realize that 100% defense.
With great respect to your gifts as a lobbyist and as an advocate for a clean environment, what was the role of the community in, for example, playing defense against toxic bills?
Well, it's so critical. I mean, we can't do what we do without our members and our activists, because we inform our members, you know, through email alerts and phoning about, say, this bad pollution bill is going to be heard in committee tomorrow, and your representative sits on this committee, so here's that elected official's phone number. Call them. You know, And those calls do make a difference. Constituent phone calls make a huge difference. They really do. But I would caveat that as when it comes from their constituent.
Right.
So we actually use more of a micro-targeting approach. The swing votes that we need on committees often are in the rural areas. So
but you have membership
in
the rural
areas. We have members in those areas, and so we activate those folks, you know, in Roswell or in Silver City to call their legislator.
Right.
And that has the biggest impact.
Right.
So
very interesting. We're talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico. So what are some of the bills against which you are defending?
On the bad side or
yeah.
the defense side? Okay, well, there's a couple bills that really you just can't, you scratch your head and think, how do these people sleep at night? But for example, there's one bill, HB 106. It's a bill sponsored by Heaton. And the name of that bill is the Environmental Civil Penalties and Reporting Bill. But our name for it is the Get Out of Jail, Polluters Get Out of Jail Free Card Bill. What this would do is if a polluter contaminates air, land, or water, and then they self-report it, they're basically given a free pass if that's their first time. So we think that would perversely incentivize them to build up one giant, you know, pollution dump and then say, oops, you know, we didn't mean to do this and we're self-reporting it. So we're being good citizens. And so penalize us.
It sounds remarkably like going to confession.
Well, you know, that would actually put into law that a confession would nullify a crime.
Right.
And we're not willing to do that, you know, if you murder your spouse and then say
to
oh,
the priest,
I did it. Okay, then you don't need to go to trial or
right.
to prison. But somehow the legislators are actually considering giving a free pass to polluters if they confess to it. And it's really unnecessary because there's already incentives for self-reporting that have lesser penalties than if you don't. But we think this basically gives a free pass to polluters, and we're going to work to kill that bill.
And what bill number is that?
HB 106. Also, HB 108 by the same sponsor, we call the No Waterways Left Unpolluted Act. But the real name of the bill is the Oil and Gas Water Quality Degradation Rules. We oppose this bill because it tells the Oil Conservation Division and the state agencies, you're not a pollution prevention agency, you're a cleanup or remedial agency if this bill passed.
Very interesting.
So say you have this favorite fishing hole that you as a kid have always gone to, and you're now taking your kids to this pristine stream in the mountains to just enjoy the beautiful watershed, and one day you see some contamination from some kind of industrial site flowing into the river. Well, of course you would be outraged. You would maybe call the state and say you've got to do something about that. If this bill 108 passed, it would handcuff the Environmental Protection Agency from saying, well, until the contamination reaches or exceeds the Water Quality Act limits, we can't do a darn thing about it. So that's just outrageous, and we're not going to allow our pristine areas to be contaminated up to the limit allowed. So that's HB 108. We oppose that one. As I mentioned, the uranium issue continues to be a big issue up at the legislature. And as your listeners know, New Mexico, especially northwest corner of New Mexico, the Navajo Nation, Checkerboard area, Pueblo areas, have many contaminated legacy sites.
When you say checkerboard areas, what do you mean?
Well, part of it may be Navajo Nation, part of it may be state land or private property, but it's still sort of Indian country, northwest
right.
area of the state.
But the fact that it is a checkerboard actually affects what happens there politically, because regulations can be made that affect state land, but they really affect Indian country too.
Right.
But
the aquifers underground, you know, don't recognize checkerboard borders.
Exactly.
So, you know, the last boom of uranium mining, which was the 50s through the 80s, left so many toxic contaminated legacy sites in those areas that we have yet to truly address. So of course, we need to do a full inventory of the problem and have and identify and get the political will to muster the resources to clean up those areas. And unfortunately, in the uranium mining industry has been pushing bills the last two sessions that we believe inappropriately tie the cleanup to the issuing of new uranium or permits for new uranium mines.
So basically, you don't get your uranium mining site cleaned up unless there's new uranium mining.
Yeah, it's saying we'll clean. The only way we can clean up the old mess is to create more mess. So we believe, first of all, that's an inappropriate approach. But this current bill, HB 84, the Uranium Legacy Cleanup Act, says that there would be a 2% tax on the mining, and that at $50 a pound right now for uranium, that just is woefully inadequate to really even begin to address the cleanup that's going to cost, you know, we don't know. But
so basically, the uranium miner, the mining companies would be taxed according to what they took out of the ground, and if it wasn't all that much, then you'd have $75 for the whole cleanup or something like that?
I believe certain projections right now say to even begin addressing the legacy cleanup issues that at $50 a pound we would need a 50% or higher tax.
Right.
Now the industry is fighting the 2%. So, but this is a bill similar to the bill vetoed by Governor Richardson last year, and his statement when he vetoed it was New Mexico deserves better. And I completely agree with that. Now, unfortunately, this bill has been moving it's been heard several times in the House Energy Natural Resources Committee. And last Friday it was voted on, and it stalled in that committee. But unfortunately, there was a weird mix of folks who voted for HB 84, even though...
Like who?
Well, Representative Brian Egolf did vote in support of HB 84.
I thought he was one of your environmental...
that was one we didn't see eye to eye on. The day they heard it, they first heard it was Tribal Day at the legislature, and nearly every Pueblo governor affected by uranium mining stood up in committee and said, We don't want new uranium mining. We urge you to vote no on this bill. It was astounding that the unanimous opposition by the tribes and Navajo Nation also stood up in opposition to the bill. So we were a little disheartened by
that.
Yeah,
I mean, we're going to be speaking to some of those leaders this coming Friday on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, great.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Okay. Well... and one other bill that, as I said, there are dozens that we're fighting, but I'm just highlighting a few of the ones that are illustrative. SB 249, the Westland TID bill. Have we talked about TIDs before, Mary Charlotte?
Tidbits. No.
Yes, tidbits.
Yes, we have. But even I sometimes have trouble retaining what all these acronyms stand for. And because this is the TID, tell us about it. It's actually something that I think it's really useful for our listeners to hear explained, because it's not totally mm-hmm. straightforward and most people don't know about it.
Sure. Well, it is a complicated mechanism for financing development that stands for Tax Increment for Development Districts, or TIDs, sometimes called TIF, Tax Increment Financing.
So TIDD.
TIDD. And this TIDs were originally conceived in urban areas that were suffering from blighted core areas that were being abandoned, and there was a sense that the only way we can encourage redevelopment of the core is through these incentives.
The and core meaning the...
The core of the urban...
The inner city.
The inner city, exactly. And so the TID policy has been a tool that in certain urban areas has encouraged development in places where revitalization wouldn't happen but for such subsidies. So in 2006, the legislature authorized the establishment of TIDs in New Mexico. And unfortunately... nobody really saw it. Well, maybe some of the developers saw it, but we unfortunately didn't see the giant loophole that was created, and that the real estate developers now are driving a Mack truck through, which allows them to claim a TID for greenfield out, you know, subdivision, real estate tracks out on the periphery of the city.
What I might call urban sprawl.
Urban sprawl. And, you know, it's our belief we should not be using public dollars to incentivize sprawl, where people are forced to then drive more, increasing vehicle miles traveled of commuters and people living further away from where they work and where they live, and also building where we're uncertain as to whether there's enough water to support those new developments.
It's very tricky business, because when you have a real estate developer doing something which is necessary, building housing for people to live in when you have a state that's growing and so on, how money is made and how costs are shared or not shared really needs to be understood better. So in other words, if I build a development, then is it my job to build the roads, to contribute to the schools, to have the water infrastructure, or is it the taxpayers who have to do that? And is it right. The taxpayers who are going to live there? So then they're paying both extra taxes and for the houses that they bought in the development. Is it taxpayers outside the development?
I don't understand. Great questions, and these are all things we're grappling with in both trying to stop certain TIDs from being issued this year at the legislature, and also numerous TID reform bills, which I'll talk about in a second. But, you know, typically a real estate developer will come in, and they were going to pay for internal roads, access roads, curbs and sidewalks, trails, parks, and public landscaping. And that's just how subdivisions, neighborhoods in our cities in New Mexico have been built over the years. But now with the TID policy, out-of-state real estate companies are coming in, and so this Senate Bill 249, the Westland Tax Increment Project Bonds Bill, this SunCal Corporation, which is a California-based corporation, has set up a related entity called Westland Development Company in New Mexico. So they're seeking $409 million in diverted gross receipts tax from the state to basically underwrite the cost of the infrastructure that we believe should and can be financed privately. Now, that gross receipts tax, the GRT, that's earmarked money that for the next 25 years will be diverted, instead of going into the state general fund to pay for environmental protection and schools and healthcare and all of our state priorities, will instead go to reservice the bonds that were issued, the $409 million bonds, to reservice those bonds that the private investors are purchasing.
And does that then actually go into infrastructure, or does it go to shareholders of SunCal?
Well, the theory of the pro-TID folks is that this will attract new revenue to the state, new companies. But we actually don't have much proof that that's happening. And in fact, we see a cannibalization sort of effect. And I know that sounds scary. What I mean, so say you have a shoe store or a Pottery Barn or Williams-Sonoma in the middle of town, and now they see this shiny new development being built on the edge of town, and they decide, well, let's move from this current shopping mall and set up shop instead in the brand new mall. So in the previous place where they were at, all of their gross receipts taxes were flowing to the state general fund. But now that community has lost those retail, and now it's in the district that, instead of the taxes flowing back to the state fund, the taxes flow to resurfacing the bonds.
Now, have you documented this kind of flow to the suburbs that you're just talking about?
Well, there are, we're in coalition with several groups, and some groups definitely have more of the economic expertise than we do. Voices for Children has done great economic analysis on this. And we're seeing now that TIDs across the country, that there's real buyer's remorse by the people in the legislatures all over the country. Illinois had to go into emergency session to revoke their TID policy. Some of the TIDs that are held up as models just are underperforming. And also, the question is, what happens if, say, the entity that gets the TID goes bankrupt? And that is a concern. We see in the press that the SunCal Corporation, which is the parent company of this Westland development, SunCal's has related entities, over 27 of them are in bankruptcy right now in California. And these are all similar real estate development projects. They're not able to pay the subcontractors now that they're in bankruptcy. And so the question is the way the TID policy is currently in statute, is this good public policy? We don't think so.
And go ahead.
Oh, and two, I think this specific request of $409 million of earmarked revenue that the state will never see really needs to have more scrutiny on it.
Now, is there a bill that you are opposing, or is there a bill that would correct the flawed, in your view, TID policy?
Well, both. That Westland TID we're opposing, but there
that's
are...
Senate Bill 249.
Exactly. But there are, half a dozen or so TID reform bills, some of which we like more than others, but some of them seek to have, say, a moratorium on TIDs until we can really get an inventory of how this is going to affect our state budget. What happens if we now grant this giant $400 million TID to a developer? The next developer behind, in line, will come into the state in a few years from now and say, well, how can I compete with that? Your state needs to give me a TID too. And it'll just be, we'll go bankrupt if we keep offering all these TIDs.
Half a billion here, half a billion there.
So I really wonder, the folks that are, the free market, private sector, knows best. What's interesting is that some of our greatest allies in reforming TIDs are also in the very fiscally conservative side, because they're worried about the impact on the state budget.
I think getting back to the real word, the meaning of the word conservatism, you're conserving, among other things, cash flow.
Well, and also, if we're going to use public money for these kind of subsidies, perhaps we want to achieve some public policy goals with that money too.
Right.
For example, and having some clawbacks if they don't do what's agreed to. Maybe we want to have some workforce housing included. Maybe you want to have certain amount of open space in the development agreement, or more environmentally friendly planned communities where you can walk to work. And now these are, a lot of the TID developers are saying we're going to do this, but we haven't seen any of those actually in the development agreements, and we fear that those would be the first thing to go when money gets tight.
Well, as we know, somebody's word is different from a contract.
Right.
when you have, and we need to move on, but for example, when you have a half a dozen bills, TID reform bills or anything reform bills, and they're all a little different, how are they reconciled? Let's say they're all voted on. Do the legislators have to choose one to support, or what if?
It just depends on, where they're moving at in the pipeline of the committees, and there are several bills that we support that get at it in a slightly different way. It's not that they're duplicative. So we'll see how those progress.
Any other bills that you are opposing that our public should know about?
Let me see. Mary Charlotte, as I said, there are just so many. There's one other good bill I wanted to... Well,
yeah, let's talk about some of the bills that you're supporting, too.
Okay. The HB 520, the Consolidated Environmental Review. We're very excited about this bill, and it was one of the top priorities of... we actually, during the interim of the legislature, we convene the broader environmental community that engages at the legislature in some form or another, and that coalition is called the Environmental Alliance of New Mexico. And the purpose of that is to make sure that we're being as strategic as possible, not coming to the session with every type of enviro bill that may or may not be viable or timely or ready to go. So this alliance seeks to get everyone on board with one or two priorities that we can convey to the legislature. This is one of the top priorities of the environmental community. It also makes sure that they don't have anywhere to hide. Then if I don't know what you guys want, they all want different things. So,
right.
So
then that's happened in the past. It has.
So in addition to the TID reform bills, the other top priority is the consolidated environmental review. And what this would do is allow for an environmental assessment process by the state, which we currently don't have. And many people assume that we do. So what that means is that, say, a cement plant or a landfill wants to get a permit for building their project, the state would then have the capacity to not only look at just the project in a vacuum, but to look at the cumulative impacts of that project on the community. So right now, the Environment Department can only look at the project in isolation and say, well, it doesn't exceed water quality standards, it doesn't exceed air pollution limits, so we have to approve it. This would allow the Environmental Protection Agencies, public health agencies, to say, look, at this community is already shouldering a disproportionate burden of industry and impacts such as asthma on their children and unsafe levels of ozone. And so the cumulative impacts will really be a huge step forward for New Mexico.
And that really gets into issues, again, which we'll be talking about on other programs on this show, of environmental justice and the reality that it's the most vulnerable communities that and the poorest communities that a lot of the time get hit with disproportionate environmental impacts.
Right. I mean, it's completely inappropriate that in Albuquerque's South Valley there's, you know, cement plants right near daycare centers.
Right.
So we believe this bill would be a great step forward in protecting communities and just ensuring that we're doing a robust process to plan for which industry and facilities are appropriate and which just are not appropriate for certain areas.
So what other bills are you supporting?
There's a State Engineer Aquifer Jurisdiction, HB 19, by Representative Mimi Stewart. I don't know if you've heard about deep aquifers.
Didn't
it was covered in the New Mexican the
other day. Wasn't there just some movement on that?
Yes. I do believe it passed out of its first committee. This would allow this Office of the State Engineer to have jurisdiction that it currently does not have over deep aquifers, which are defined as 2,500 feet or deeper.
Right.
And I believe when that was, when the jurisdiction was defined, we couldn't imagine being able to drill that deep for water. But now the technology exists, and there actually seems to be a bit of a Wild West rush now to go mine that brackish, highly saline water. And the concern is that, well, one, we need to map these deep aquifers. We don't know
if
they're connected.
And that's the state engineer's job.
Well, we're saying that this bill would give jurisdiction to the state engineer to regulate those deep aquifers because, if, say, a housing development is planned and they say, well, we have water for the next 75 years. Look, we've just drilled a well into this deep aquifer. But some water experts suspect that many of these deep aquifers are non-replenishing, which means that once it's used once, it's not going to fill back up again.
Right.
And so what happens if you build a whole community out on the on the mesa that in 75 years runs out of water?
And 75 years goes by quickly.
It sure does. So that's a really great bill. A great bill, Representative Brian Egolf has some very good renewable energy bills. There's also his bill, HB 219, the Free Market Energy Restoration Act. This is taking the Surface Owners Protection Act a few steps further. In the Galisteo Basin experience, many people were surprised to learn that they didn't own the subsurface mineral rights, even though they were surface owners of their property. Say they had a few acres out there.
So you own your garden, but you don't own
the mineral rights
underneath your yard. Yeah.
So my understanding is that this bill would give more time for the owners to be notified, say if the state land office is leasing mineral rights, that they would be notified of those lease sales, and giving them more time to negotiate with the mineral right owners, the potential exploration of resources on their property. So that's sort of an overview of what we're dealing with. One other bad bill I'll mention is HJM2, House Joint Memorial 2. Now, these aren't bills per se as much as an aspirational statement, but this is the disposal of greater than Class C waste. And what that refers to is what WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, what sort of waste they would be able to take. They currently take nuclear weapons waste, but this would expand what they could take to take commercial nuclear power waste, which would in effect make it the next Yucca Mountain. And so we're opposing that House Joint Memorial too as well.
And so how do people in the area where WIP is feel about that whole issue? Do you have a sense of that?
I have to admit that that's one of the areas that's been a challenge of building membership for us. But it's southern New Mexico and the southeast corner. We would really like to find ways to engage citizens down there more. But, you know, it is it's probably not viewed the same way as it is maybe by Santa fans or by your audience. Some folks down there view it as, you know, job creation, as WIP has been viewed, and also there's now the Eunice uranium enrichment facility in that area.
What's the reality of the safety concerns around putting nuclear waste in the caverns there?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on WIP, but I'll just say, just imagine the volume of trucks driving our New Mexico interstates would increase significantly if now nuclear power plants from across the country were shipping their commercial waste to us. The safety concerns are...
But luckily, there's no drunken drivers in New Mexico that might have
right.
an accident with those
or
trucks.
Driving,
so really, we
driving
should be
the
fine.
Wrong way, yeah, so we would be fine.
We're talking to Sandy Buffett, the executive director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. So Conservation Voters New Mexico and the voters of New Mexico have made strides toward having more pro-environment legislators in the House and the Senate of this state. Where are we at next to people who are supportive of environmentally positive legislation?
Sure. Well, as I said, we were thrilled by the results of the 08 primary and general elections with our endorsed candidates winning so handily. But this is going to be a marathon, not a sprint for us. We have a Senate Conservation Committee this year that could be a lot friendlier to us than the current composition. I would like to thank Speaker Ben Lujan for House Energy and Natural Resources Committee that we've been able to work very well with. But we're not yet to that pro-environment majority, as I mentioned. So CVNM is going to be working through both holding legislators accountable for how they vote and through our PAC working to elect in 2010 and 2012 more pro-environment representatives and senators so that we can have that. So that we can shift from not playing so much defense to actually passing visionary pro-environment policies that protect our air, land, and water. I mean, it'd be great if our lobbyists didn't have to be running around the building stopping all these bad things and could actually work hand in hand with the sponsors of our good bills and really get the word out more. You know, that's actually one of my regrets is that if I was able to hire 5 more lobbyists, then we could not only be the ones saying, stop this bad bill, stop that bad bill, but we could actually be promoting and helping as advocates get the great, get the pro-environment bills I mentioned, this the deep aquifers bill, the TID reform bills, and the Consolidated Environmental Review. We could be working with our champions more strategically and getting those passed through the committees and eventually signed by the governor.
There is this whole question of the people, the many, many lobbyists with a lot of money, with a lot of time on the side of industry. And again, we've discussed this before, but people who run industries have to breathe the same air that we do and drink the same water. And when global warming dries up the rivers of the West and the beetles eat all the trees and so on, we're all worse off for it. And
that's right.
What kind of education do you think is necessary for people who are involved in industry? And yeah, everybody needs to make a living and companies want to make money and so on. But to kind of everybody be on the same page and still have an economy.
Right. Well, the collective environmental community of New Mexico and of the world really is grappling with how do we get to that realization. Our comparative advantage as an organization is the political part, that we don't have biologists on staff or economists, and we are thrilled when our sister organizations are doing the lawsuits and doing the plantings and all of those collectively build a consciousness of environmental protection. Our area is really being the lobbyist voice and the electoral voice of the environment here in New Mexico.
Do you have contact with lobbyists from the so-called other side?
Well, you know, we often are in a room negotiating. We've been in rooms with mining lobbyists, energy utility lobbyists. Certainly we do look for places where we can find common ground, if there is common ground. There isn't always common ground. We're not willing to compromise in areas that will really, threaten public health and our resources. But the legislature, it is a place where you can have friends. We certainly have relationships on both sides of the aisle. We are collegial and friendly to some of our industry counterparts, but not all of them. I think it goes back to the elections and what we call the cycle of accountability, and that's if we're there in the building holding elected officials accountable for the way they're voting on environmental issues, but if we're there for them when they do the right thing, and by being there for them I mean we're there helping them get reelected, they remember that. And so that's the cycle that we're trying to create, an upward spiral of environmental awareness and action, and frankly, results.
If people want to get involved with Conservation Voters New Mexico, how do they do so?
Well, they can call our office, which our phone number is 992-VOTE. 992-8683, yeah.
992-VOTE, okay.
And they can go on our website, which is cvnm.org. Another website I'll mention is a environmental bill tracking site that we constructed. It's called protectnewmexico.org. And that, it does require some login. You have to get a password. But for people who really want to dive into, if they want to see all the water bills up there, or they want to see all bills that relate to renewable energy, they can do a search on our database and customize and track those bills. And all the environmental advocates up in the Roundhouse use it on a daily basis. So, and just if you want to contact your state representative or your state senator on any of the bills I've mentioned today or on any other issue, they can always call the Capitol phone, which is 986-4300.
And that is in the area code 505 here in the state capital of New Mexico. Sandy Buffett, Executive Director of CVNM, Conservation Voters New Mexico, thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break right now. Linda Siegel will be with us in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR.